The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is the name of Barbara Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, the strength of the jobs market is continuing to support New Zealand's economy. Statistics New Zealand reported this morning that the unemployment rate remained at a record low, 3.2% in the March quarter. The number of people classed as unemployed stood at 94,000, which is 29% lower than a year ago and 19% below where it was in the pre-COVID December 2019 quarter. On comparable measures, New Zealand's 3.2% unemployment rate stands against 4% in Australia, 3.8% in the UK and the United States, and 5.8% in Canada. The OECD average is 5.2%. Mr. Speaker, this is a very positive result in what has been a challenging environment and is a sign of confidence in the economy and the government's strong health response and sound economic management. Our economy is growing at 5.6% annually and is above pre-COVID levels, while our fiscal position is strong with AAA credit ratings from leading agencies. The recovery is growing momentum and the easing restrictions and opening up to skilled workers and tourists will help businesses and the economy rebuild.
Supplementary. What did the report say about wage growth?
Well, Mr. Speaker, wage growth rose at a faster rate, with the average hourly wage up 4.8% to $36.18 an hour. Statistics New Zealand also reported that 64% of workers received annual wage increases in the March quarter, compared with 46% a year ago. Mr. Speaker, we recognise New Zealanders are doing it tough at the moment with regard to cost of living increases, but our strong economic and fiscal position means that we are well positioned to respond and help ease the pressure on New Zealanders. The half-yearly update forecast from the Treasury also indicates that 2022 is the only year in the forecast period in which inflation will outstrip wages. Mr. Speaker, the investments made by the government to keep businesses open and Kiwis in work has paid dividends. Projections of 10% unemployment were avoided because of the actions we've taken, and today's numbers highlight how successful our plan has been to keep and support New Zealanders in work.
Supplementary. What did the report say on growth and employment?
Mr. Speaker, the data also shows that the economy continued to add jobs with 2,000 more people in work than in the December quarter, with the strongest growth in construction and manufacturing. The total number of people in work is now 114,000, above where it was in the pre-COVID December 29 quarter. Hours worked did decline by 0.2%, which reflects the challenges from Omicron as more people were away from work due to illness or having to self-isolate. ANZ's economist said the labour market remained tight in the March quarter despite the best efforts of the Omicron wave to disrupt things. With indicators of labour demand still at or around record levels, ANZ are expecting that the labour market will further tighten over 2022 as domestic COVID disruptions ease, and this is where the important role of immigration will come to play as we fill much-needed skill gaps.
Question number two, Christopher Luxon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads, does she stand by all of her government's statements and actions?
Mr. Speaker, yes. In particular, this government's economic recovery plan, which has seen our economic activity increase 5.6% from a year ago, higher than it was before COVID-19. Our goods exports up by more than 8% compared to March 2020, and milk powder and meat exports are up by more than 15%. And we've received two AAA credit ratings from the two leading agencies, something few countries in the world are able to say. We always maintained that a strong health response to COVID-19 was the best economic response, and we're prepared to step in with more than $20 billion of direct support for businesses and workers through the wage subsidy and resurgence support to protect lives and livelihoods. And Mr. Speaker, you can see today the impact that has had. Our unemployment rate remains at 3.2%, one of the lowest recorded since the survey began. The average hourly wage rose 4.8% to $36.18 per hour, and private sector wages increased by 5.3%. Our economic policies during COVID mean we are now in a strong position to grow the economy and support New Zealanders through these uncertain times.
With wages growing slower than prices and real incomes falling, does she agree that Kiwis are going backwards under Labor?
Mr. Speaker, as I've said in this House many times before, that since we took office right through until 2022, wage growth outstripped inflation. And Mr. Speaker, yes, we are in a period where we have now obviously inflation at high rates in the same way the rest of the world is experiencing. But even then, there are, of course, forecasts that predict again, once again, from the latter half of 2022, we will again see wage growth outstrip those increases in the cost of living. Mr. Speaker, I contrast the government's approach in these times to some other parties in this House. We're investing in supporting New Zealanders through these tough times, targeting our support, lifting minimum wages, increasing the family tax credit, bringing in the winter energy payment. When the opposition wants to take away, Mr. Speaker, from New Zealanders investment in services and give tax breaks to the wealthy.
Why is she refusing to accept that Kiwis have gone backwards under Labor when total inflation since she became Prime Minister has been more than 13.5%, during which time total wage growth has been under 9.8%?
Mr. Speaker, my argument would be that the member is refusing to instead actually listen to the answers that I'm giving. We absolutely accept that alongside the rest of the world right now, the rest of the world is experiencing high rates of inflation. The euro, 7.5%. Germany, 7.3%. The US, 8.5%. The OECD average is 7.7%. Now, the difference is that since 2017, we came into this crisis with wage growth outstripping, Mr. Speaker, inflation in successive quarters. And we will get back to a place where that happens again because of the actions of this government. And, Mr. Speaker, it is the latter part of 2022 when we expect that to happen.
Is she aware that quarterly inflation has been higher than quarterly wage growth for 10 of the 17 quarters since she became Prime Minister? So Kiwis have gone backwards more than half the time she's been in power.
Mr. Speaker, I reject what the member has claimed and again revert back to the answers that I have provided. And again, let's look at the policies that have been proposed in this House around supporting Kiwis at this present point in time. This government has increased the minimum wage. This government is looking at ensuring that we don't see a decline to the bottom through things like fair pay agreements. This government has increased the family tax credit, brought in the winter energy payment, brought in the Best Start payment, increased government support. On the other side, we have a party promoting an increase in the age of retirement, no increase in the minimum wage, and, Mr. Speaker, tax cuts for the most wealthy.
That's right. True story.
Order. I'm going to warn Mr. Ducey, if he addresses me in that way again, and while he might in fact be accurate, he is not to bring me into the discussions in that way. David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Prime Minister, does the Prime Minister stand by her statement that New Zealand is, quote, open for business? And if so, what does she say to Kiwis of, for example, Indian, Chinese or Sri Lankan origin, who hear the country is open for business but can't welcome their non-resident family at Auckland Airport into the country anytime soon, let alone defined by her government?
Mr. Speaker, well, for many of those families, they may already have family members who hold existing visas that have multiple entry. There are hundreds of thousands of those in existence who are able to be utilised right now. And as I say, they are multiple entry visas that can be used. The issue is, Mr. Speaker, the opening time for those from non-visa waiver countries, those who have not sought specific visas for entry into New Zealand from the reopening dates. We are looking at the possibility of bringing that reopening forward. But again, there are already hundreds of thousands from those countries who can still come now.
Supplementary. What is stopping New Zealand, from simply treating those Kiwis whose families originate out of non-visa waiver countries the same as those Kiwis whose families do come from visa waiver countries? Why is that so hard?
Mr. Speaker, if the member is promoting the idea of the complete liberalisation of our immigration system where everyone is treated as if they are from a visa waiver country, because actually the answer was implicit in the question. We do have different visa requirements. And by virtue of those, Mr Speaker, and the fact that we are already processing residency visas, over 100,000, to ensure that we maintain our workers here in New Zealand. We, of course, are processing our critical workers, which we've opened back up to, working holiday visas. It is simply a matter of sequencing, but we are looking to bring forward those as early as we can.
How can she say Kiwis aren't going backwards when annual inflation is 6.9%, but wage growth has just hit 3%, the biggest gap between price and wage growth on record?
Mr Speaker, as he would have heard, the member would have heard in both the Minister of Finance's response and in my own, the average hourly wage rose 4.8% in the latest data, and private sector wages hourly earnings increased by 5.3%. We are in a period right now where we have got global inflation levels, Mr Speaker, that are impacting on the cost of living. But these quarters are, relative to the others we've experienced in New Zealand, an exception, not a rule. And we are projected by the latter part of 2022 to once again see wage rates wage growth outstrip the cost of living. Mr Speaker, finally, what I would say is that as a government, we have worked hard to ensure that we've consistently had wage growth outstrip inflation in this country, and we have succeeded. But we are in an environment where there is currently a war in Europe. There are supply chain constraints, and we are not alone in this experience. The difference is we're a government who will cushion the blow for New Zealand. That is an opposition party proposing to give the wealthiest tax cuts.
Why does the government believe yet another working group is the answer for tackling ballooning waitlists under Labor, health waitlists?
Mr Speaker, if the member is referring to the fact that, unlike other countries, we have not had the extended, extraordinary increases in wait times throughout the pandemic because we managed COVID in a way that allowed people to continue to access healthcare, but that now we are using our clinicians in an environment where we are no longer hamstrung by the geographical boundaries of DHBs, are going to maximise the efficiencies of our health system. If that member suggests we shouldn't use clinicians to support that work, that's a matter for him. But on this side of the House, we think that's a good idea.
David Seymour.
Does the Prime Minister believe her government has done enough to fix the cost of living crisis? And if she does believe that, why does 77% of New Zealanders disagree with her?
Mr Speaker, I am not for a moment going to argue that there is a silver bullet to the global issue of high inflation rates. There just simply isn't. But there are ways that we can make a difference, reducing the cost of fuel, increasing support for those on low incomes with the family tax credit increase, the winter energy payment. All of these things make a difference. But, Mr Speaker, ultimately, what we do want to get back to is the position we were in prior, where wage growth was outstripping the rates of inflation, and we're projected to do that later in 2022.
What will the new health working group achieve that the 1,600 staff at the Ministry of Health can't?
Mr Speaker, with the Health New Zealand reforms, there is opportunity for us to ensure that we are better utilising our tertiary system to overcome the inefficiencies that we have had. Mr Speaker, the member may not be aware, but individual DHBs operate often using different categorisation and criteria to prioritise planned care. That in itself, Mr Speaker, creates inefficiencies. We don't operate as a combined network of tertiary care. We need to. That is what the Health NZ reforms are about. That is what these clinicians will support. And if the member is not aware of the differences between the way that our DHBs have worked to date, then I suggest the member get a briefing.
Question number three, Angie Warren-Clark.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Energy and Resources and asks, what action is the government taking to support businesses to cut their emissions?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Dr Megan Woods. And can I ask Mr Seymour just to speak a little bit more quietly on his phone?
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, last week I announced the government is supporting even more of New Zealand businesses to slash their emissions faster through the latest round of the Government Investment in Decarbonising Industry Fund, or the GIDI Fund. In partnering with the private sector through the third round of GIDI, we're helping to clean up production processes and help businesses reduce their emissions. Of the $13 million investment, this is matched by $32.7 million in private sector funding. Across all three rounds of GIDI, 53 projects have received $69 million in government co-funding, matched by $117 million in private sector funding.
Supplementary. What will be the impact of the government's investment in decarbonisation?
Mr. Speaker, projects funded through the latest round of the government's investment will save 900,000 tonnes of CO2 over their lifetimes. The third round of GIDI will achieve annual emissions reductions equivalent to taking 14,400 cars off our roads. All three rounds will result in lifetime emission savings of 7.46 million tonnes of carbon. This is the equivalent of taking 134,800 cars off the roads. The GIDI Fund is already making a tangible difference to the total greenhouse gases that we generate, and it's great to see regions right across the country benefiting, including Southland, Otago, Canterbury, West Coast, Nelson, Hawke's Bay, Bay of Plenty and Auckland.
What kind of projects have been supported through the GIDI Fund?
Mr. Speaker, Southern Paprika, where I announced the successful projects, is set to install a biomass boiler with a CO2 recovery unit, a New Zealand first, replacing fossil gas. This project will reduce emissions by 70% by replacing 70% of the process heat requirement with a renewable energy source. Other projects include funding to convert coal boilers and heat recovery at McCain's Timaru plant and Matara Valley Milk to install New Zealand's first high-pressure electrode boiler of 15 megawatts to replace all current coal-fired heat duties on the site, making the site 100% electrified.
Question number four, Jan Logie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety and asks, what new actions, if any, will he take in light of Mind the Gap's research, which concludes that pay gap reporting is likely to close Aotearoa's gender and ethnic pay gaps by as much as 40% and increase pay by as much as $35 per week for the average worker?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety, I thank the member for her question. The government is committed to improving employment outcomes, supporting pay equity for all women in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and I acknowledge the advocacy of Mind the Gap on these issues. I'm closely considering a range of matters that the Education and Workforce Select Committee has raised in its briefing into pay transparency. The government will be responding to these shortly. We continue to support pay equity through a range of other actions, including through fair pay agreements, pay equity settlements, reducing the gender pay gap in the public service through targets and measures, and soon we'll be delivering the first ever Women's Employment Action Plan to remove barriers that prevent women from entering work and support better employment outcomes for them. There is more work to do, and it will take the work of businesses, unions and government alike to tackle the bigger issue of pay equity. Yeah.
Supplementary. Does he agree that an extra $35 for women, Māori and Pacifica workers, which is an extra 8 loaves of bread, 5 dozen eggs or a bus pass, would make a real difference to working families right now?
Mr. Speaker, I do want to caution that picking pay transparency reporting as the panacea is the only panacea to the gender pay gap. 40%. Pay reporting is one of the tools that could help us towards eliminating pay gaps. Other tools that we are already implementing include fair pay agreements, pay equity and leadership targets in the public service. The government has also delivered a suite of improvements from the 1st of April that will see income increases for over 1.4 million New Zealanders.
Supplementary. What is the Minister's response to research by Te Ara Ahunga Ora Retirement Commission, which shows that the KiwiSaver pay gap is increasing, with women having 20% less in retirement savings than men, in part due to the cumulative impact of the gender wage gap?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, the discrepancies that are happening in the KiwiSaver and wage gap is a symptomatic of the wider issues that are occurring in the gender pay gap and the drivers that cause that. I happen to know that my colleague, the Minister for Women, has commissioned some research around this, and I look forward to having future conversations with her about this.
Nice. Supplementary. What is the Minister's response to the Education and Workforce Committee's final report into pay transparency, which found that the government should urgently adopt mandatory pay transparency reporting and require organisations to take action to address inequity?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I found that the report from the Education and Workforce Select Committee was incredibly helpful in discussions that we will be having going forward in this. We have the mandatory 60 working days to respond to that, and we will be responding to that in due course. But we do take this issue very seriously, and nothing at this stage is off the table.
Does he stand by his statement on the pay gap that, quote, there's a strong level of commitment? We want to examine the evidence, we'll examine the Select Committee's report, and then we'll make considered decisions, unquote. And if so, now that he has evidence from the committee and Mind the Gap that comprehensive pay gap reporting does work, will he finally take action?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, to the first part of that question, absolutely. To the second part, we are working through those recommendations at the moment, and our report will come through, our response to that report will come through shortly.
Supplementary. How much longer will women, Māori and Pacifica, bear the cost of pay gaps because the government has not started work on legislation to introduce comprehensive pay gap reporting, which was promised last term by his predecessor and the then Minister for Women, Julianne Genta?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, while there is a gender pay gap, there is more work to be done, because while there is a gender pay gap, it is completely unacceptable, which is why we have taken work on implementing fair pay agreements, pay equity settlements, increased paid parental leave, leadership targets, and a dedicated Women's Employment Action Plan. We are taking action to reduce the pay gap.
Question number five, Rachel Brooking.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Building and Construction. What are the trends in building consents granted since 2017?
The Honourable Porter Williams.
The government has overseen a significant increase in building consents since we took office in 2017. We are building more houses than ever before and delivering the homes that New Zealand whānau need. This is reflected in the data released yesterday that shows a record 50,000 building consents in the year to March, which is up 24% on last year's figures. This shows ongoing support for the biggest government building program in decades, and that our economic recovery is continuing to gain momentum.
Supplementary. What other trends are being seen in building consent data?
Mr. Speaker, it's not just more houses that are being consented. We are also seeing an evolution in the sector as more medium and high density residential buildings are consented for construction. In March 2022, we saw 2,172 townhouses, flats and units consented, as well as 616 apartment buildings. These are both well up on this time last year. And while many of these consented were in Auckland, we are continuing to see the growth of these consents in regions like Waikato, Bay of Plenty, Gisborne, Wellington, Nelson and Canterbury.
What other effects is this drive in construction having?
Mr. Speaker, as our fourth largest workforce, the construction sector continue to grow to meet this demand.
In the year to March, the workforce added 13,225 more jobs and is continuing to grow with 30,000 people supported into construction-related education or employment opportunities through the Construction Skills Action Plan. When you combine this with the ongoing work the government is leading with industry through the Construction Sector Accord and through successful policies like free trades training, we're making sure we've got the workforce we need for now and into the future.
Question number six, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, does he consider the government has done enough to alleviate the cost of living crisis facing New Zealanders, and will he rule out measures to provide them income tax relief in the upcoming budget?
As I've said in this House on a number of occasions, the government is extremely conscious of the impact of the global energy crisis and supply chain constraints are having on households, and in particular those households who are the most vulnerable to increases in food and petrol prices. That is why, building on the support that we have provided through COVID, we have cut fuel excise duty by 25 cents a litre and halved the cost of public transport. We've introduced a raft of measures to increase income support, including family tax credit changes, childcare assistance, student allowances and main benefits, and we've also lifted the minimum wage. We're very aware that this remains a difficult period for many New Zealanders, and the government will continue to work on ways that we can improve the economic security of New Zealand against these sorts of global shocks. In answer to the second part of the question, times like this require all political parties to think about what their priorities are and to make difficult decisions about where resources should be directed. We do not agree that tax cuts that favour those who earn the most are the priority right now. And we are not alone in this view, with the IMF saying during their recent assessment of the New Zealand economy that now was not the time for major tax changes.
Why is it that despite a record budget spend up and another year of debt and deficits, he still can't find room for tax relief for the squeezed middle?
Well, Mr. Speaker, on this side of the House, our focus is on making sure that we support New Zealanders through this difficult time. The households that are the most affected by those inflation rises, peaks in prices of petrol and food, are those that we have been focused on with the support that we put through on the 1st of April and by making sure that all New Zealanders can benefit from the cuts in the fuel excise duty. Mr. Speaker, we always have to get a balance right here. There's no free lunch. If we want good quality public services, we have to keep investing in them. And we saw the damage done when the last National Government was in office and failed to invest in them.
Supplementary. Does he believe a family receiving an average household income is too rich to deserve income tax relief?
Mr. Speaker, what I believe is that all households in New Zealand deserve quality public services, a good health system, schools, housing, making sure we have transport routes in place. And yes, we will continue to support all households, for example, through the cut in fuel excise duty and also through the halving of the cost of public transport.
Supplementary.
Has the Minister of Finance received any advice that suggests the squeezed middle starts at an earning bracket of $180,000 a year?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, no, I haven't seen that advice, but remarkably, what I have seen is a proposal that would see those earning more than $180,000 a year getting thousands of dollars of tax cuts, but someone earning $40,000 a year getting $2 a week, Mr. Speaker. That doesn't seem to me like a good use of the government's resources, or indeed good for the most New Zealanders.
Supplementary. How much more income tax did the Crown collect in the 2021 fiscal year compared with the 2017 fiscal year?
Mr. Speaker, the member knows if she wants an answer to a detailed question like that, she should put it down in writing.
Order. Order. That's the end of it. Further supplementary?
Tree. Can he confirm that data released by StatsNZ today shows that no matter how you measure it, costs faced by New Zealanders are rising faster than wages, meaning Kiwis are going backwards in real terms?
Mr. Speaker, what we saw today from Statistics New Zealand was that there was a 4.8% increase in annual average earnings over that year. That is less than the current annual inflation. This is the only year in the forecast period where that is true, and it was not true in the period building up to this. Under the Labor government, we have made sure that New Zealanders' wages have continued to lift. We currently have a global inflation spike. That is a struggle, and we are supporting New Zealanders through through it. What I do note, Mr Speaker, is that whenever we come to this House with measures that actually lift the incomes of low and middle income people, like the minimum wage, like fair pay agreements, like the 1 April changes, the National Party oppose them. On this side of the House, we're actually doing something to support low and middle income New Zealanders.
Supplementary. What does the global energy crisis have to do with the biggest increase in annual average rents in New Zealand records?
Mr Speaker, the global energy crisis is part of the inflation story. Another part of the inflation story is the cost of housing, which is built on the fact that building supplies being imported into New Zealand are indeed rising. I think 18% in the last numbers, far in excess of the other causes of rising in housing prices.
Three. Why won't he simply give some of the additional $14 billion he's collected in income tax back to New Zealanders by inflation-adjusting tax thresholds?
Mr Speaker, on this side of the House, we know the damage that can be done when a government doesn't invest in the health system so that we have sewage leaking down the wall of hospitals. We know the damage that's done if we don't fix school buildings so that children are learning in cold, damp environments. It is always about getting the balance right. And on this side of the House, we believe that part of getting the balance right is investing in public services and supporting those on low and middle incomes. What is not getting the balance right is giving tax cuts to people who earn more than $180,000 so they'll be thousands of dollars better off, while someone on a minimum wage is about $2 better off. That isn't fair. That isn't a good use of resources.
Mr Speaker.
Question number 7, Rachel Boyer.
Tenakwe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Local Government. Will the Three Waters reforms benefit smaller communities? If so, how?
The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Mr Speaker, yes. The reforms will deliver the benefits from scale and aggregation, primarily by leveraging waters infrastructure across large regions to finance infrastructure investment and improve water services to all communities, and especially small communities. In Nelson, for example, over the next 30 years, the increase per household without reform is forecast to increase by $2,330 per household. With reform, households will be paying instead $1,260. But let's look next door to Marlborough, because the forecast increase in cost to households without reform will be $6,560 over the next 30 years, in contrast to, with reform, $1,260 per annum. That's got to be good.
Supplementary. What response does she have to concerns that small councils and their local interests will be deprioritised by larger council areas in the four large entity areas and the Three Waters changes being proposed?
I was initially concerned right at the beginning when I heard those types of concerns, which is why we tried to ensure that they were being addressed within the context of the changes that we're proposing. However, I'm particularly grateful to the recommendations of the Governance Working Group for their suggestion to improve the changes that we're making by establishing sub-regional committees to ensure local priorities are consulted on and being addressed within the context of the reform. This means also that we will be responsive to consumers and ratepayers, and their needs will be the subject of greater scrutiny than is already happening in the current case under economic regulation. We know that when those benefits are being reported on to ratepayers, there will be greater transparency over the benefits of this reform that will meet the household needs of deserving communities, big and small.
Supplementary. How will the interests of...
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister, if councils get one share in the new water entities for every 50,000 ratepayers, how many shares would Waitaki District Council get with 23,000 population, or Manawatu with 33,000? And would that give them the same rights as shareholders under the Companies Act?
Mr Speaker, as I've already explained, those communities with 50,000 people or less will get at least one share. That's an important principle when we consider that across a large entity, small communities will be able to benefit from scale and aggregation, where there will be a smoothing of cost benefit to those households. If there's an alternative that that member has and is willing to put on the table, I'd be grateful to hear it.
Simon Watts.
Does she think her reforms will benefit the communities in the Kaipara, Whangarei and the Far North District Councils, who will have a total of 5 shares in Entity A between them, while Auckland have 35?
Absolutely. And across Entity A, they have the added advantage of Watercare, which has already delivered demonstrable benefits through scale and aggregation that will only translate to benefit communities in the Kaipara district. And if the member has an alternative that he is willing to put on the table, I'd love to hear it.
Gentry, how will the interests of local communities... How will the interests of local communities...
Can the member start again? The very senior member should know better.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How will the interests of local communities be provided for in the proposed reforms, and what assurance will they have that local priorities will be provided for?
Thank you for the question, and can I just draw the attention of the House again to the helpful recommendations of the Governance Working Group, who suggested that included under the regional reference group that each entity can establish sub-regional groups that will bring local decision-making and set local priorities in such a way that that can be reflected through the water service entity by way of investment prioritisation methodology and framework set by the water service entity, included within the context of the Statement of Strategic and Performance Expectation, the Statement of Intent, asset management plans, funding and pricing plans, and the overall infrastructure strategy for that region. It will assure small communities that their priorities not only are being listened to, but are being planned for.
Kieran McInulty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister, can she confirm that ratepayers in the South Wairarapa District Council and the Tararua District Council are projected to face fees of $8,690 without reform, but $1,260 with reform?
Yes, and that's why these reforms are so necessary.
Order, order. Do any of the members asking questions from their seats want to stand up? All right. Question number 8, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, what is his target, if any, for the reduction over the next 12 months in the number of people waiting more than 4 months for a first specialist appointment, and what specific steps, if any, will he take to achieve this?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On behalf of the Minister of Health, I've been advised that under the current system and without any change, it could have taken between 3 to 5 years to address the current waiting lists. That is why this morning it was announced a task force to systematically go through the waiting list and to develop a plan to clear the backlog. This is the first opportunity we have had to address a major nationwide health problem, treating the health system as a single nationwide health system. It is my expectations that with this approach we can clear the backlog faster than had we not taken this measure. However, I am realistic enough to know that COVID is still with us and that the future outbreaks, possible outbreaks, will continue to create challenges for our health system, and today's announcement is every bit we can to make sure that we can continue to serve our population.
Supplementary. Why has he waited until now to accept that ballooning waiting lists are even a problem, given waiting lists have increased by thousands every single year since this government came to power?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, that's exactly why when we came into government we looked to serious health reform work, knowing full well that the system did not deliver in its entirety to our entire population. We made it quite clear that the postcode lottery doesn't work when it looks towards servicing our health needs in this country. That's why the health reform is important, and this morning's announcement will make sure that we use all the levers of the new reformed health system to deal with this issue.
Supplementary. Is announcing yet another working group really the best effort he can make for the 36,000 people waiting more than 4 months to see a specialist?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, this morning's announcement is an important announcement to make sure that not only do we look towards the short-term challenges in front of us with the waiting list, but also have a plan to the mid and long term in front of us. And I find it rather interesting from that member when in this House last night he rubbished Māori health professionals over the past 200 years in the work that's being put forward for the Māori Health Authority, and now he's calling this esteemed group of health professionals just another group.
Supplementary. How many more people will be added to the waiting list between now?
Order. Can I just ask senior members of the National Party to let their colleague ask the question without interruption?
Supplementary. How many more people will be added to the waiting list between now and when his working group presents its plan in another 4 months' time?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I don't have those figures in front of me, but what I will say, Mr. Speaker, is that currently DHBs are already working on the immediate plans to address these matters. This particular group will also provide us invaluable information and insight to make sure we have a medium to longer term plan.
Supplementary. How many people have been added to first specialist assessment waiting lists every year since this government came to power?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I don't have that information at hand. I'm sure if the member puts it in writing, he'll get a fulsome answer.
Question number 9, Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Police. What recent reports has she seen regarding the disruption of organised crime?
Mr. Speaker,
the Honourable Porter Williams.
I've seen a report the police will continue the success that they have had disrupting organised crime by commencing Operation Cobalt. This operation will be a major nationwide effort by police and will build on the significant inroads made by Operation Tōwhiro, which to date has resulted in taking 1,531 firearms off the street, arresting 1,255 people and seizing 53 kilograms of meth. This government will continue to support our police in their efforts to disrupt gangs and organised crime.
What will Operation Cobalt mean for police efforts already underway, such as Tōwhiro?
Mr. Speaker, Operation Cobalt is the next phase in police effort to crack down on gangs and organised crime, and will use the insights and learnings from Operation Tōwhiro to put even more pressure on gangs. Operation Cobalt will be supported by an additional 300 organised crime staff that have been deployed since 2017, with an additional 400 to be deployed by June next year.
What other reports has she seen regarding police efforts targeting gangs and organised crime?
Mr. Speaker, I've seen another report that in March this year the Police Asset Recovery Unit seized a number of assets and bank accounts funds worth a combined value of more than $7 million. This included 4 properties, a bank account containing $1 million, a Lamborghini Hurricane, and a Ferrari. These assets belong to a Patch Mongrel Mob gang member who has been charged in relation to conspiracy to import methamphetamine and money laundering.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Minister, if increasing the police budget by $450 million has resulted in a huge increase in crime, what would she expect the effect of reducing youth services funding by $10 million to be?
Mr. Speaker, I disagree with the way that member has characterised this particular issue. We have had to build the police from the base that the National Party left us, frozen funding and police numbers dropping. In order for us to be successful in supporting the police, we need to give them the tools, the resources that they need to do. $450 million worth of increased funding, and by the end of by the middle of next year, 1,800 more cops.
Well done. A point of order, Nicole McKee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I did ask what the effect of reducing youth funding by $10 million would be, and she had not actually addressed that issue.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, the member had two parts to her question, and when it's a supplementary, there's only an obligation to address one of those parts, and the first part was certainly addressed, if not answered. Question number 10, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, has MSD been enforcing work-related obligations for the 176,000 1,763 job seeker support recipients since work-related obligation failures were suspended between 23 March 2020 and 27 May 2020, and if not, why?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Kia ora, Mr Speaker. On behalf of the Minister, yes, the Ministry of Social Development has resumed the use of work-related obligations since June 2020. Of the current number of job seeker support recipients, 108,105 actually have work-related obligations. Others may have health conditions or disabilities that mean these obligations do not apply. Mr Speaker, as you can see from our continued low unemployment rate of 3.2% released today and our record-breaking levels of people going off benefit into work, this government is successfully supporting more New Zealanders into work.
Supplementary. Can she explain why sanctions for failing to attend a work appointment in the March 2022 quarter were 67% lower compared to the March 2020 quarter?
Mr Speaker, this government has a different approach to the punitive, cruel, uncaring previous national government. And the reality is, Mr Speaker, that we don't just apply sanctions easily, liberally. We look at what's happening with the whānau, Mr Speaker. We look at what's happening in the community. We look to see if there's domestic violence happening in their whānau. Is there intergenerational unemployment? Is there drug use? Unlike the previous National Party who just stopped benefits at the drop of a hat.
Why, when unemployment is 3.2% and firms are crying out for staff, have 110,000 people been on the job seeker benefit for longer than a year?
Mr Speaker, this takes time. We inherited, I'm glad the opposition support what I'm going to say. As we all know, we had an opposition.
Order. No, member, resume your seat. Members don't want to hear the answer. Karen Chaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Does MSD have any mechanisms in place to detect job seeker beneficiaries who are not truly looking for work but are just box ticking on their benefit obligations, and if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, of course MSD has processes in place. We've got a very good man. Well, have a listen, Seymour, and you might learn something. You're so stupid. But
the member was marginal until he addressed my stupidity. Please focus on the answer, Mr Jackson.
Thanks, Mr Speaker. Again, MSD does have processes in place, and they include people who go into our communities and work with those different groups and whānau to find out what the problems are. The last thing that this government wants is people on benefits forever and a day. The minister and myself have worked with people at the coalface, unlike the opposition, who wouldn't know some of our people if they fell over them. We've worked at the coalface, and the last thing we want is people on benefits forever and a day. We want our people to find out what's happening in whānau. We don't want them languishing on benefits, but we want to get them skilled up so that we can have a better New Zealand for everyone.
Supplementary.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Does the Minister think anyone on a job seeker benefit should have to decide between having their safety net ripped out from under them or being pressured into any job, no matter how unsuitable?
No, Mr Speaker, I think that's a good question. And I think the challenge, and we think the challenge, is getting the balance right. We have to get the balance right in terms of this. And I respect where the member is coming from and understand many of the problems of our people, particularly young people on benefits. But we have to find a process where they're not rotting the system, but we also don't want to be as punitive, cruel and ugly and horrible as the National Party.
Louise Upston.
What does he say to meat meat processing firms, like the one I met with last week, who are having to export full carcasses because they cannot get job seekers who they will train to fill their vacancies.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the member for the question. I actually went to one of our meat processing firms last year because I came from the meat industry. And so I do understand the problem. And in fact, in my day, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there were hundreds who used to line up for jobs. Now they can't get some of those young people. So it's about us working actively with employers. And what we're doing about is working with them actively and supporting them in terms of strategies where they can attract people from our communities. It's not about us just punishing and being punitive with people, which is the National Party strategy. It's about working in tandem with the community and trying to upskill them, which we're doing through programs like Mana and Mahi, He Potama Rangatahi and Māori Trade Training. Programs that the National Party never rolled out.
Supplementary. If the government cannot get the 110,000 people who have been on the job seeker benefit long term into work, when there are chronic staff shortages, when will they ever be able to?
Mr. Speaker, the hope is that through our continual upskilling and training programs, our push and our support in terms of communities, that our people will come through. The numbers have been terrific. We've seen the unemployment rates at a record low. We've seen the Māori unemployment rate is at an all-time low. What does that tell you? It tells you that our targeted programs are working. It's telling you that the people that the National Party forgot are actually getting an opportunity. And that's what this government is focusing on. This is a long process, and we've still got a few years to go yet as a government.
Question number 11, Willow Jean Prime.
Tēnā koe te māngai o te whare. My question is to the Associate Minister of Housing, Māori Housing. How is the government partnering with iwi Māori to deliver new homes for whānau who need them the most?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Kenny Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On Friday, I travelled to Taranaki to announce a new investment partnership between government and iwi collective Ka Uru Ora to build up to 172 new homes for whānau who need them the most. This partnership will deliver affordable rental housing across Taranaki and around the central and upper North Island, getting whānau who need those affordable rentals into secure, warm and dry homes quickly and on iwi-owned whenua. It is funded from the Whai Kāinga Whai Oranga Kaupapa and the government's record $730 million commitment to accelerate Māori-led housing solutions and represents an innovative new approach to unlocking and enabling Māori housing solutions.
Supplementary. How does this partnership reflect the government's wider strategy for Māori housing?
Mr. Speaker, last year we launched our national Māori housing strategy, Mai Hi Ka Ora. It promised partnership, investment and most of all action. Friday's announcement sees us delivering on the promises we made in Mai Hi Ka Ora and Whai Kāinga Whai Oranga to do things differently and work in partnership with Māori to deliver a better Māori housing future for our whānau. Ka Uru Ora were identified through the National Iwi Chairs Forum last year to partner with the government to deliver Māori housing in their rohe, and Friday was the culmination of their engagement with government to develop an innovative way by Māori for Māori housing solutions.
Supplementary. What reaction has he seen from Ka Uru Ora about the announcement?
Mr. Speaker, as I said at the event on Friday, this is a groundbreaking step that will help unlock intergenerational wealth and aspirational wealth in housing, and the partnership was accordingly well received. Whānau Engagement Manager Te Waka McLeod also highlighted that the projects in the partnership would enable Māori housing aspirations, and getting one whānau into the housing that is right for them can have generational impacts. Ka Uru Ora Chair Jamie Tuta said the partnership would help the iwi deliver critical affordable housing solutions for our whānau, and that it would provide an opportunity for better saving habits, but also to be able to deal with any debt and think about what's required for that whānau to move to the next stage of the housing continuum. Mr. Speaker, I'm very proud of that announcement.